Welcome to The Science Line. I'm Scott.
And I'm Risa. We're here to learn about the science that's happening here in our Idaho community, but we're also challenging scientists who dare to come on our show to think about how they communicate their research to people who know nothing about it, but whose tax dollars are funding it, like us.
But we're not going to take it easy on our guests. They will have to pay for their communication faux pas, like using ridiculous and unrelatable science terms and jargon, and they better not bore us. Based on how well they do, we'll assign them written homework in the form of lines. Hopefully, this will remind them of their blunders and what not to do next time.
Geez, take it easy, Scott. No one's going to want to come on our show if you keep carrying on like that.
So, Risa, we're back with the Science Line, and I hope you've recovered from all the excitement of having your students on the show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, man, it was great having those guys on the show. They're doing some really good work getting out into the community and educating people about the COVID-19 vaccine.
Absolutely, and that's such an important topic right now.
It definitely is, but I'm curious, Scott, what important topic are we kicking the show off with this week?
Well, I've been watching a lot of TV over the last year.
Oh dear, what an awful way to start an intellectual conversation.
Okay, but hear me out. So I've noticed that on the television and on social media, we've been seeing such an increase in the number of figures and graphs that we're seeing in our daily lives. And on the news, we're often seeing news anchors use graphs and figures to explain things like the number of COVID tests conducted in the US each day, for instance. And this is something that's become so much more of a big deal over the last year.
Yeah, it seems like graphs and figures have become more commonplace in the news and on social media, especially with COVID.
Yeah, so it got me thinking, what are some of the key questions we need to ask ourselves when we see a graph or a figure on the TV or on social media?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think what you're getting at is, what do we need to ask ourselves to make sure we're actually interpreting the information correctly?
Yeah, exactly. So I read a really good article in The Conversation, which is an online depository of articles, most commonly written by professors. And this one was written actually by a Boise State professor.
Ooh, some insight from someone pretty close to home here in Idaho.
Yeah, exactly. And this professor said that the next time you see a graph or a figure, be it on TV or social media, you need to ask yourself three key questions. And the first of those questions is, what is this figure trying to tell me?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's definitely a sensible first question, right? And so as a scientist, when I see a graph, I start by reading the title, looking at the axis labels, and checking the caption.
Precisely. Without first understanding the axis titles, however many of them there may be, it's very, very difficult to actually contextualize and interpret a graph.
Yeah, it's also very important to look for things like units of measurement associated with the axis labels. That will definitely help in interpretation of the graph.
Exactly. Another question the Boise State professor asked us to consider is, how are color, size, shape, and perspective used?
Ooh, that's another important question. You know, as I think about color, color is usually used in graphs or figures to draw attention to patterns or to draw our eyes to certain features.
Yeah, so perhaps to stick with the topic of COVID, if you're looking at a map that describes the number of cases in each particular region, you may automatically assume that red areas have more cases than green areas. But to make sure this is actually the case, you need to check the legend. So, for instance, if somebody's trying to mislead you, or if they're just bad at making figures, they may have flipped the perceived meaning of the red and the green. We often think red is worse, green is better.
Exactly. And whether it's deliberate or not, we might get the wrong impression if we don't check the legend. So another thing to think about, Scott, is why somebody has chosen a particular type of graph or figure to display some type of information. So a pie chart, for example, might be useful if you have three or four segments of the pie. But this same type of pie chart can become really confusing and difficult to read if you have, say, 10 or more categories. Then you have to ask yourself, is this figure deliberately trying to confuse or mislead the reader?
Yeah, exactly. So certain types of graph are best used in particular situations. So as you say, a pie chart is best used when there are only a few slices of the pie. It's easy to read. Whereas if you have loads and loads of slices of pie, you have to think, okay, this clearly isn't the best way to present the information. Why am I seeing it in this manner? Perhaps I should actually be very careful here.
Right.
So another example of a poor graph, which is actually brought up in this Conversation article, was used by the White House Coronavirus Task Force last April. And this graph was a bar graph, and it described the cumulative or the total number of COVID tests performed last April per day. And the White House Coronavirus Task Force used the figure to support their claim that the daily number of tests were increasing in the US. However, their figure actually provided the audience with no information on the number of daily tests that were being conducted, just the cumulative or the total number of tests, which of course shows an upward trend, even if the daily number of tests stays the same, just because it's cumulative. So day one is added to day two, day one and two are added to day three, and so on.
Wow, you can see how that can become really confusing to somebody who is just watching this on the news,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and not actually and taking the time to consider that axis.
Yeah, exactly. That can be very, very, very confusing. That's a really, really great example, Scott, of how it's important to understand the axes. And hopefully those axes are labeled properly so that somebody could get accurate information from that. That's another important point.
Exactly. And the final question posed in this article is simply, where does the data presented in the graph or figure come from?
Oh man, this is probably the most important question of all. You know, if you're reading a peer-reviewed academic journal, you might be a little bit more lax on asking this question. But if you're on social media or watching a political broadcast, you might want to check the data sources.
Yeah, so perhaps we're talking about bias here?
Oh, for sure. You have to think about, is what I'm watching or the information I'm getting, is this an impartial source? Or are they supporting a particular agenda? Or we have to think about the accuracy and reliability of the source. So for instance, if we're reading an academic paper, it'll detail how the data was collected and the strength of the sample. However, if the source is a Facebook poll, we have to consider the inherent biases that may be present in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, who knew graphs and figures could be such a minefield?
Oh man, I know. Be careful out there, people. This week on The Science Line, we are joined by Idaho State University Biology Doctor of Arts student Sophie Hill. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Risa.
Sophie, it's great to have you on the show. And for our listeners who might not know, what actually is a DA or a Doctor of Arts student?
Sure. Yeah. So a doctorate of arts is a doctoral degree, but I kind of describe it as student teaching for college professors. And it's actually what brought me here to ISU was this cool degree program where we have the chance to do internships in classrooms with faculty and staff here at ISU to help improve our own teaching while pursuing biological research.
So as a DA student, you're really getting experience in both teaching or pedagogy and research.
Absolutely. That's combining great. Them often, which is really kind of a fun idea, which is why I joined the program.
Do you have an example of how you've combined your research with sort of the teaching element?
Sure. I do a lot of work in cities and looking at biogeochemical cycles. And so I've done some internships looking at how students model or create biogeochemicals cycles in the classroom and how we can use those as assessments.
Wow. That's really cool. Well, Sophie, we are going to start out today by asking you if you were well behaved in school and if you ever had to write lines on the board.
Ooh, such a good question. I was a really quiet student. I sat there in the back and was so afraid I would get in trouble. And I still remember in first grade, I was working ahead of class. And the teacher wrote my name on the board because I was moving ahead without everybody else. And I got in so much trouble by myself. She wasn't that mad at me. But I went home and was crying and told my mom about it. And yeah, so I was your model student, I think.
And you were actually too well behaved for school.
In that moment, yes.
In first grade.
It was devastating. Here I am all these years later.
Exactly.
So the whole idea of asking you if you're well behaved in school is because here on The Science Line, we like to dish out lines at the end of the show.
Nice.
So if you do really well at communicating your science, then you don't get very many lines at all. If you do really, really rubbish, then we give you lots of lines.
Okay, no pressure.
That's right. And our understanding is that your research encompasses somewhat the topic of urban stormwater. Mm-hmm. And so we have written your particular line around this topic. And so your line is, I will not flood listeners with useless information.
Fantastic. Very applicable.
And your goal is to remember that line so that when we come back to it at the end of the show,
yep,
you can tell us what it is.
Okay, so without any further ado, let's get started with the first segment, which is the Why Do We Care segment. So this is when we give you 2 minutes to explain to us and our listeners what you do as a scientist and why they should care. No pressure. Good luck.
Well, I feel like I have an unfair advantage here because Scott and Risa, you guys both live in Pocatello, right?
We do.
Absolutely.
I study Pocatello. So listeners, if you live in Pocatello, you should definitely care because I happen to study your neighborhoods. Yeah. But we also have listeners who don't just live in Pocatello. So anybody who lives in any sort of a city or an urban area, those are the kinds of places that I study. And quite often people find themselves not realizing that, you know, normal ecological things happen in cities. So like photosynthesis happens in the city. The water cycle happens in a city. All of these things you learned about in science class continue to happen in these cities. And so what I do specifically is, if you guys like soak your lasagna pan after dinner, you know how the water gets really nasty and gross. Well, the same thing happens in stormwater, okay? So if you're looking at your gutter and you have all those leaves and the junk that's sitting in there, water comes along from rain or snow melt, and then stuff soaks into that water. That water flows off the city and doesn't get treated. It doesn't go to the wastewater treatment plant. It flows straight into the Port Neuf River. And so what I study is Pocatello's trees, all the trees across the city, the stuff that falls off them, so blossoms, leaves, fruit, things like that. The stuff that falls off, I leach in water to see how that'll impact the stormwater that flows off the city. So it's kind of a convoluted but interesting research that actually takes place in the place where a lot of people live.
I want to pause for a moment to let you know that you're listening to The Science Line. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with DA student Sophie Hill. Stay with us for questions and trivia on The Science Line.
Listen to KISU live on your home's Amazon or Google smart speaker by telling it, play KISU. This is KISU FM, Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg.
I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. We're now going to jump back into our conversation with DA student Sophie Hill.
So Sophie, that was a great 2 minute summary of what you do regarding stormwater and essentially the lasagna pan and how gross that gets, you know, when it's wet is a great illustration. Now, as we were researching you, we saw that you're part of a socio-eco-hydrology research lab, and that's a real mouthful. So what does that all mean, or is your 2 minute segment describe all of that already?
Well, as I mentioned, my 2 minute segment was pretty much perfect. Mm-hmm. But one of the things...
Scott's like, we'll see how many lines you get. We'll see if it was perfect.
So the term there is basically we put together a lot of parts of different words just to say, yep, we study socio, meaning people, we study eco, meaning ecology, and we study hydro, meaning water. Ah. So people, the water, and how that all fits together in the ecosystem. And so kind of a complicated mouthful, but when you break it up, it's like, oh yeah, people, water, and the ecosystem.
So you mentioned there that you study stormwater.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had to actually give a definition of what stormwater is, how would you describe it?
This is where I'm going to get lines because nobody wants to learn what stormwater is. So stormwater is just the water that falls onto the city. And you can imagine that if the city weren't here, it would just fall in place and it would soak into the ground and it might flow in little tributaries. But stormwater itself, because it's falling on this built environment where there's lots of concrete, lots of pavement, the channels, the gutters are very angular, like it flows on different paths than you would expect or than would be there naturally. And so as this water flows, it obviously picks up a lot of stuff along the way. As a mother of three small boys, I know there's a lot of urine and parking lots out there. But that's the sort of stuff that flows off of the city because, and there are obviously other pollutants, leaking oil off of cars, salt. We're coming off of winter, there's a lot of salt that's been happening on the roads and just a lot of other pollutants. And specifically what I study are nitrogen and phosphorus, which we don't often think of as a pollutant that's located in that stormwater. So it's just this hodgepodge, kind of a complex chemical cocktail that flows off the city. And smells as well.
Why do you care about nitrogen and phosphorus in particular?
Yeah, so when you're thinking about nitrogen and phosphorus, those are two elements that are building blocks of life. So if I'm holding up a leaf here and staring at it, I'm actually, if I had really, really amazing vision, could see the little nitrogen molecules in the chlorophyll and the phosphorus and things like that. So as that leaf breaks down, those molecules obviously break down and dissolve into the water. So those molecules are what were needed to make the leaf. Mm-hmm. And those molecules are actually what's commonly found in commercial fertilizers that we distribute around the city and around a lot of our crops. And so by studying how much of that is in our stormwater, I'm basically studying on whether or not we have too much fertilizer in our stormwater.
I'm curious what a typical research day looks like for you doing this type of work and going around the city.
Sure. A lot of variety, actually. So one of the projects that I did was I went around and walked every street in Pocatello and documented all the different trees that we had. So I spent a summer walking around in an orange vest with a phone, just literally looking up at trees and recording what the different species were. But another thing that I did is I distributed litter baskets, literally laundry baskets, sitting around Pocatello. So if any of the listeners have seen those, that was me. And in those laundry baskets, the leaves or the blossoms would fall into that. And I would collect those every week and take it back to the lab and weigh it, measure it, and see how much was falling off. And then one of my favorite parts of the project I would actually take that stuff and I would put it in bottles, kind of the size of your regular Nalgene bottle, inside the lab and put really, really pure water over the top of it and basically cold brew tea using gutter stuff.
Oh, my God. No way.
And looking at the differences. I mean, just look at the differences of color alone of soaking a crab apple blossom versus a green ash leaf versus a Nora maple seed. Some of that was kind of an interesting little project. And I have some fun photos that I can't show your listeners.
So I read that you're also a keen citizen scientist.
I am.
So what does that mean? What is a citizen scientist and how are they valuable within the scientific community?
People have this idea that scientists are those people out there. They're not me. They're people inside the university, inside those labs. But I think that the power of using citizen science is you're using people who are way more familiar with the system, especially when I'm talking about studying Pocatello and its neighborhoods. You're using these people who are truly experts in this area and asking them to help you, the scientist, to collect additional data or information or just ask unique questions that you might not necessarily be familiar with. And so citizen science is just kind of getting involved with the people in these places, having them help collect data, having them help conduct research and contribute to the science that's actually being done around them.
So, Sophie, have citizen scientists helped you on your project in particular?
Yes.
Oh, can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I did have a group of citizen scientists come through and they helped me photograph and document storm drains. The grates that are in the gutters that nobody pays attention to. They went and helped me document those along different neighborhoods in Pocatello, taking pictures, and we used an app called AnecData to upload the information. Mm. They collected samples as well of what was actually in there, which was not the favorite part of most of my citizen scientists.
So I mean, how did you recruit them? How did you get them on board? Because, I mean, convincing someone to go, like, take pictures of drains is probably not the easiest thing ever. No offense, but it doesn't sound the most glamorous.
You only give them a little bit of information first. No, I understand. Most people who are like, oh yeah, I want to go bird watching to help somebody, or it's kind of the more glamorous approach. But I did recruit within the university community. I recruited at the environmental fair and I had a lot of help from the Master Naturalist chapter. The local Master Naturalist chapter helped me.
Yeah, awesome. There's a team of scientists out there just waiting to help everyone.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should transition to some trivia. Okay. We've questioned you for long enough. So, well, I was reading about your research here, but I also saw a little write-up about what you did before you got ISU.
Oh, no.
So this might be a little unfair because it doesn't relate necessarily to your current research, but I'm just going to ask it anyway because I can.
Do it.
So I read that you spent two summers at the Oregon Institute of Marine Biology in Charleston, Oregon, and you researched the predatory behaviors of sunflower stars. And now I have to admit, I didn't even know starfish were really predators, but you know.
Wait, so sunflower stars That's another name for a starfish?
Yeah, starfish.
Yeah, so okay. My undergraduate advisor was real stickler. He's like, they're not fish. We don't call them starfish. So he always called them sea stars. Oh. And so I spent a lot of time calling them sea stars and having people go, what? Starfish? Yes, starfish is what we're talking about here.
So my question to you is, how fast can an adult starfish or sea star move?
Ooh, it depends. Oh. It depends. So the typical ones that you think of when you go to the ocean coast, the little five-fingered, that's not the right word, five-armed ones, they don't move very fast at all, hardly at all. But these ones I studied, the sunflower starfish, they're really fascinating. They can have up to 24 arms. They can be up to a meter across.
Wow.
And they book it. And I'm talking like moving about, I would say maybe this fast, which I'm trying to think how to
For our listeners, I don't even know how to describe what she just did.
Something like maybe an inch a minute, you know, like we're talking some serious movement here.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit faster than that. But if you're thinking about being something that a starfish is going to eat, like a clam, if that's coming at you, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you got no chance. Yeah, so I don't know if I can do the conversion between inches per minute and
The actual answer.
Meters
yes,
per minute.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, we always try, because we know nothing. We have to write everything down. So yeah, apparently an adult sunflower sea star can move at the astonishing speed of 1 meter per minute.
Oh, wow, that's way off.
Can have as many as 1,500 tube feet.
Oh, 15,000, like...
Oh, yeah, 15,000
tube feet.
I could
feet.
Read, it would be helpful.
And so, like, 1 meter per minute, that's roughly 3 feet?
Yep.
Per
I
minute.
I was way off.
I didn't even realize they could really move. I thought they were just sort of stuck there, but... Which is bad, because I also studied marine biology for a year. Obviously not very well.
We moved on.
Do you miss marine biology, Sophie?
I do. I have a love for the ocean. Really, really did, but...
There's no dolphins in Pocatello Stormwater.
No.
Or sea stars.
And my interview here at ISU was a little awkward, too, when I was like, I study marine biology. I know you don't do that here at ISU, but, you know.
That's funny.
Well, I'll take you back to Stormwater so you feel more comfortable now.
That's a good question.
Where is the largest storm drain on Earth?
Ooh, on Earth? Oh, heavens.
Not in the heavens. On Earth.
Oh, I'm going to guess somewhere in Europe.
No.
Why, though? Why somewhere in Europe?
Because...
Clearly no.
I like to get in my nose quickly.
You do.
It's the most satisfying.
It makes him feel terrible. Yeah.
Scott told me I'm wrong. And Chris is like, well, please explain why you're wrong.
Yeah. It's the mentality difference. Uh-huh.
I was going to say Europe just because I... figured they had a lot of old, aging stormwater infrastructure there. I don't know.
That's a good guess.
It is. It's a good guess, even though it's wrong.
Excellent effort.
So it's actually 19 miles north of Tokyo.
Oh.
And it's something called the GCANS Project. It's the largest storm drain on Earth. And it's a colossal series of underground silos and tunnels that's actually built to protect Tokyo from flooding due to typhoons.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty incredible. It has the capacity to clear 200 cubic meters or 53,000 gallons of water per second.
Wow. Yeah.
And I actually read that you can, when it's not stormy, there's not loads of water everywhere, you can actually go on a tour around it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I could see them making money off of something like that. Like, you want to take a tour?
Yeah, I know.
It'd be kind
of
cool.
Imagine suggesting that to someone like, do you want to go on a tour of a drain? I mean, Sophie might be interested.
I'd sign up.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to just think of like the scale of that infrastructure.
Exactly.
It's just so massive. And they make it that big because they needed it to be that big. And so that's, you know, taking that tour might be a good dose of perspective.
It's a good way to think about it. Okay, so I hope it's fair to say that one of the main reasons to study stormwater is to prevent pollution of our rivers. And we've sort of talked about that today, so I feel like that statement is justified. So my question is, what is the most polluted river in the world?
second guess myself. I was going to say the Nile.
So it isn't, but there is a fair bit of debate about this. I don't know about the Nile, but common consensus is that the Sitarum River in Indonesia is actually the most polluted river in the world.
Mm.
And apparently it's so polluted that in most places you can't even see the water.
Wow.
It's covered in so much rubbish.
Debris.
And they've lost about 70% of the species that live in that river.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Scott, we've reached that time where we have to assign some lines to Sophie based on how well she communicated her science today. But before we do that, Sophie, do you remember what your line was?
I may not find it. I will not flood these listeners with useless trivia.
Useless trivia. We do that anyway. You don't need to worry about that. We've got that covered.
That's right. I will not flood listeners with useless information. So, Scott, how do you think she did? Did she flood our listeners with useless information or rubbish, as you would put it?
No, I think you did really, really well, actually. But what do you think about the number of lines?
Oh, man. I agree. I think Sophie did great today. And so we're going to give you the same number of lines as the average number of days of precipitation in Pocatello, which is, do you know?
I do not.
97.
Who knows something like that? No one should just know that.
Oh, man. Thanks for coming on the show, Sophie. We had a really fun time with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us on the Science Line today. If you are interested in being on the show, please contact us at thescienceline@isu.edu.